Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. Coming up later in the show, we'll speak with Ocean City's Emergency Services Director, Joe Theobald, about the predictions for this hurricane season and the lessons Hurricanes Sandy and Irene taught us about storm preparedness in our region. And in just a few minutes, I'll sit down with Salisbury Chief of Police Barbara Duncan to talk about Maryland's new gun law and whether the strict regulations will get guns off the streets and out of the hands of criminals. But before we do, I chatted with Steve Green from the Maryland Coast Dispatch about the region's top headlines. And while we didn't talk at great length about the government shutdown, we started with the dispute that essentially caused the government shutdown, the debate over the Affordable Care Act. Here on the shore, there are approximately 20,000 people without health insurance, and as they try to figure out if the Affordable Care Act is going to help them get coverage, businesses are trying to figure out what they must do to adhere to the new rules without breaking the law or the bank. Green says many folks are still quite confused.
A lot of small businesses are really right now, over the last couple of months, trying to educate themselves on what it exactly means. You know, we have advisors, you know, from my company specifically, and all small businesses are the same way, that offer health insurance to their employees. There was a form that we had to give out as prior to October 1st that stated that all employees, whether they're covered or not, have the option of logging into the health exchange and weighing their options. Mm-hmm. You know, as you know, the law requires that every uninsured individual get insured. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, there's a penalty involved in it. Right. And that goes into it. That will come through on the tax, you know, on your tax returns. You know, so is there this flood of people heading to the web to look at the exchange and weigh their options? Honestly, I looked at it just curiosity. You know, I'm covered, fortunately, and my family's covered. But, you know, I was interested to see what exactly the difference would be if I were to go with one of these six private insurance companies rather than what I have currently. Right. And I would assume that other people that have health insurance are doing the same thing, specifically the ones who do not have health insurance. You know, so the businesses are probably at this point have done their due diligence, need to realize exactly what it's going to mean for their bottom line. Mm-hmm. You know, from my employee standpoint, I'll be interested to see if any of them opt out of our coverage to go through the exchange. Right. Of course, that would be on their dime, and that would be something that we would have to deal with on a case-by-case basis. And all the other businesses, same situation.
The name of the bill, it's often called Obamacare, but it's the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
I've heard that, you know, I've heard people describe it, since there's been so much question about what it's going to mean and what it's going to do, that this is making it affordable for people who don't have insurance, but it's not necessarily the most affordable thing for businesses. Is that a fair assessment in your eyes? And I guess, what do you think businesses here on the coast, many of which seasonal, that employ, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people on a seasonal basis, does that mean that they have to cover all of their workers that are here only a few months a year?
Right. I don't think that does mean that they have to cover them a few months of the year. You know, there is strict legislation or strict rules in there that offer guidelines to basically all size businesses. 50 and under, there's a certain set of rules. 50 and over employees, there's a certain set of rules. You know, for those businesses that are higher on a seasonal basis, there is a concern, and a lot of them have adjusted already. Even like the town of Ocean City, for example, right, which is a business, you know, they made adjustments last year in advance of this new law that required basically a certain amount of employees became part-time employees, technically, rather than they really kept an eye on their hours to ensure that they were part-time rather than full-time. You know, and that's a big difference. That's a lot of financial difference that, you know, governments and businesses need to have been following and operating under.
I had heard one of the council members say, we need to change this drastically so we don't have to fulfill what the Affordable Care Act is bringing to the table because it doesn't make sense for us from a financial perspective. But what message do you think that sends to workers, you know, who say, yes, I do a job for you and I get paid for it, but why do you not value me enough as an employee to cover me from a health perspective? Do you think that that message is sent when, you know, businesses and municipalities are making things happen purely from sort of a bottom line perspective?
Man, that's a really interesting question. You know, from the employee's perspective, I'm sure there are many people that feel that way. You know, and that's probably an unintended side effect of this law.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are a lot of positives to this law. You know, there, you know, hospitals are seeing declining enrollments. People are being laid off. That's a result of this increased expense for healthcare. I do believe at its most fundamental, this bill is looking to reduce the cost of health care. You know, obviously that if you know trickles down to the you know the most wealthy to the most impoverished. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think, you know, unfortunately politics, as often the case, has kind of muddied the waters here. You know, like today I really came in and looked at the health exchange to see, and there's a lot of really good fundamental information mm-hmm. on there that people can read that's it's non-political. Yeah. And I think that's something that we all need to try to keep an eye on or try to remember to try to take the politics out of this. This is about reducing the cost of healthcare across the board for all of us. And, you know, that means jobs. And, you know, there is the unintended side effect of people losing their job that are part-time. And that's an unfortunate consequence, but I just think that's a new reality.
Yeah.
Transitioning a little bit to some other political things that I've seen in recent weeks, Worcester County Commissioner Judy Boggs has announced that she'll be retiring and she won't be running for re-election. Current County Commissioner Louise Goulias has had some health problems, and she's had a long and illustrious career in many people's eyes. But with Judy Boggs basically taking her name out of the ring, that's going to lead to, well, who's going to take her seat? And, you know, with Louise's future in question as well, as far as her political future, of course, what do you see happening in Snow Hill in the coming years? Who do you think are going to be the players that will be putting their names into the hat and saying, I would like to be the next person sitting down? We've heard a little bit about current Ocean City Councilman Joe Matresic throwing his name in the hat. There was kind of a peculiar incident with his political Facebook page. Do you think Joe Matresic will run for one of those seats? And if he does, what happens to the current majority in Ocean City on that count?
Yeah, I mean, I think Joe Matresic will run for county commissioner. It's been no secret that he has expressed interest in that seat. You know, last week there was, he has a Facebook page called Elect Joe Matresic that he began prior to the November of 2012 election. And at some point last week, that name was changed to Elect Joe Matresic County Commissioner. And then it was immediately changed back to Elect Joe Matresic. So there's some funny business there that nobody really has any idea how that takes place. You know, that's a pretty tricky virus that made that happen, if that was the case, or somebody logged in under him and changed that. Regardless of that, he has expressed interest in the past anyway on being a county commissioner. So I believe that there is something there. You know, I think, you know, the odds are that County Commissioner Louise Goulias will not seek her seat again. You know, for one thing, she's been in office since 1998. And she has had health issues as well. You know, so we're really interested to see if Matresic throws his ring in the hat. It will be halfway through his term in Ocean City, which basically gives him a free shot. Mm-hmm. If he loses, he can go back to being a city councilman, and that's that. You know, but though Matresic, if he runs, will not run unopposed. There will be competition, and I think that's a great thing. The impact that it would have on the city council, if he were to be victorious, well, then they would have an open seat. They would have to have a special election. And then that opens up a whole other realm of interesting possibilities, right, as far as who would run to seek that seat. To me, a really interesting thing that's happening here is, you know, we're early on in political season, but next June is the primary. To June, in the middle of June in Ocean City, that's going to be really interesting to see what kind of turnout we have. You know, I believe that the change was made to increase turnout on a state level and to allow more time after the primary leading to the general election.
We've been speaking with Steve Green. He's the publisher and editor of the Maryland Coast Dispatch. Steve, always nice to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian, for having me.
We head now to Salisbury for a sit-down with Police Chief Barbara Duncan. Over the past few years, Salisbury has been working diligently to get violent crime under control. And the department, under Duncan's leadership, has made huge strides in reducing crimes across the board, including crimes such as armed robbery, murder, and rape. But as Maryland's new gun law finishes its first week on the books, I wanted to know what role the local police department will play in implementing these strict new regulations. Maryland State Police officials will, of course, play a pivotal role in the fingerprinting and safety training that are part of the new law. But as Duncan told me, the role of the local department is, for the most part, unchanged.
Our responsibilities remain essentially intact as far as the enforcement of gun laws, how we deploy in an attempt to bring gun violence down on the city streets here in Salisbury, and then through our Safe Streets Coalition, how that all affects us and the partnerships that we have throughout the county and beyond. Our responsibilities, our role essentially remains the same. We are committed to reducing gun violence. This law provides some extended areas of coverage, certainly when you get into banning of assault weapons and expanding background checks and keeping weapons away from individuals that have been deemed prohibited under law. Certainly those particular areas, we're seeing an expansion in those areas.
I was at a gun shop here on the shore last week, and the gentleman who owns the gun shop was showing me assault weapons or semi-automatic weapons such as the AR-15. He was showing me some of the ones that were going to be banned under this new law and other ones that will still be allowed. And two particular guns that he showed me were both different models of the AR-15. One was to be banned, one was to not be banned. They looked exactly alike. And he basically told me that they are essentially the same gun. What challenges does that create when you have certain guns that are banned and other guns that are not banned, but seemingly look very similar?
Oh, I think the challenges are huge. You know, these weapons can, in some cases, look, even the most innocent of weapons, weapons that are not prohibited, can look very much like weapons that are prohibited under law. And it takes a little bit more than a quick interaction on the street to make that determination, to figure out whether or not you're dealing with a prohibited weapon or not.
Now, this new law, it'll require fingerprinting and safety training for the simple purchase of even a handgun. You know, many states only require such actions for, you know, if you want to carry a gun, if you want a carry permit. The new laws also limit magazine capacity to 10 rounds and ban 45 types of firearms that have been deemed to be assault weapons, as I just mentioned. How long do you think this bill will take to start getting guns out of the hands of the people who shouldn't be having them?
I think it'll be almost immediate. First of all, when you're dealing with, the one thing that I really like about this law is the fact that there is now finally a training requirement, an educational component to this law, which is great. Not only does this law require a purchaser to get firearms training, but it also requires the purchaser to attend a course on firearm safety and safety in the home. So these things are essential, and I couldn't applaud the legislature more for pushing forward on this aspect of it. I think that the training component will greatly reduce the number of accidental discharges that we see, and also add an additional layer of security inside the home to a firearms purchaser that might not otherwise take any security precautions inside their home.
That was one interesting thing that I found in the past several weeks, was this new trend of people, when they want to buy a gun for home protection, instead of going for a simple handgun or even a rifle, as you know, was very prevalent where I grew up, and many people of our generation grew up with a handgun or a rifle in the house. Now, seemingly, the choice for many gun enthusiasts is to get these sort of AR-15s, these semi-automatic weapons. Does that concern you that there is seemingly an arsenal of guns or very high-powered guns in homes all around the community?
The fact that they exist in homes doesn't so much concern me. There are a lot of level-headed, clear-thinking, good Americans out there that own weapons. What concerns me, though, is that individuals purchasing are not taking the time to consider what they can effectively manage and handle. Effectively, the worst thing in the world is to purchase a weapon and not be familiar with it and maybe have it used against you or a loved one inside your home, and you had every righteous intention when you went to purchase that weapon. There are a lot of considerations that you have to make when you're purchasing a weapon. First and foremost should be whether or not you can actually use it effectively. That's a big concern for us.
I read a report that the ATF released a few years ago, and it cited that stolen guns only account for 10 to 15% of the weapons used in crimes nationwide. Unlicensed gun dealers, street dealers, they seem to be kind of the bigger problem. Does this bill address that, and is that the real rub when looking at this issue from a long view, getting guns off the streets?
Well, that is a larger issue. That I'm not going to contest. That is something that law enforcement has to work towards, really drilling down into that particular problem. When you're talking about illegal sales on the street, when you're talking about your ordinary law-abiding citizen, I don't necessarily believe that you're talking about an additional burden here with this law. The two things that I like about this law that kind of push towards removal of weapons from the street environment are the mandatory reporting now. If your gun is lost or stolen, you have 72 hours from when you discover this problem to report it. Secondly, another big push to get a lot of these guns off the street is the mental health changes to this law, which in law enforcement we've been requesting for a number of years now because we see it. We deal with the mental health issue on the street. In fact, here in Wicomico County, we've built a coalition with our mental health authority. We're developing our own crisis response team in conjunction with our mental health authority right here. It is such an important component to this law, and I'm glad to see it here, that we can finally actually begin to define this problem and address it appropriately in a way that's actually manageable and positive.
Is there a way to quantify the amount of guns that are on the streets in the hands of criminals?
There is. Right now, it's more of a, unfortunately, and I'm sad to say, more of a reactionary quantifier. We track every handgun assault that we encounter, that we capture here inside the city limits. We capture our homicides as well. And, you know, as you rightfully said, we have seen a decrease in violent crimes. We went from 7 homicides in 2010 down to 1 homicide in 2011, 1 homicide in 2012, and year to date so far we're tracking at 0. We also track by way of assaults with a firearm. Again, those numbers are starting to track down. They're trending downward as well. So we're making strides. It's not where I want it to be right now, but we are making some significant progress. You know, I think that this law goes a long way to reducing the number of illegal guns that we'll be dealing with, that, you know, the officers out in the street will be confronted with. You're going to have that criminal element that is going to try to circumvent this law. But I think we're in a better position now dealing with reduced numbers. Moving forward, you're not going to reach back and collect all of those weapons that are currently out there. They're going to be there. They are there. But I think that this is that bright line that we can look to work from.
That was Salisbury Police Chief Barbara Duncan talking with me about the new gun law in the state of Maryland. We'll take a short break, but we will return in a moment. I'm Brian Russo, and you're listening to Coastal Connection.